Blog Talk Radio.
Without the light or the darkness comes, hold through the night, the shadows will run. Fend off the enemy, sing out the jubilee with all the fire we can breathe. We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know, night time, morning time, yeah. We're going strong, heading up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling, I feel a change on the rise. What good's a man who's lost his soul? Can't take a stand when his flame's gone cold. Fend off the enemy, sing out the jubilee with all the fire we can breathe. We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know, night time, morning time, yeah. We're going strong, heading up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling, I feel a change on the rise.
Chapter 1, The Dawn of the Guardian. Title, The Genesis of the Trust Guardian and the Birth of AI. In the heart of the bustling city, nestled among a forest of towering skyscrapers, a young man named Bidzil Bey found himself in the epicenter of the financial world. His office, dimly lit by the city's ambient glow, was a testament to the complex world he was about to navigate. Strewn across his desk were a myriad of financial reports, legal documents, and trust agreements, each one a piece of the intricate puzzle of trust administration and compliance. Bidzil was not just any young man, he was a legal prodigy, fresh out of law school, with a keen interest in the intersection of law, finance, and technology. His journey was just beginning, a journey that would lead him deep into the labyrinthine world of trust law, a world filled with fiduciary duties, asset conveyances, and beneficiary rights. His mission was clear, to revolutionize the way trusts were administered. He envisioned a future where the complexities of trust law could be simplified, where compliance could be ensured with the click of a button, and where transparency was not just a goal, but a reality. This was the genesis of the Trust Guardian, a concept that would merge the legal expertise of a trust officer with the efficiency and precision of artificial intelligence. It was a bold idea, one that would challenge the status quo and transform the industry. The birth of the Syntactical Trust was the first step in this journey. This innovative approach to trust administration harnessed the power of AI to streamline processes, enhance transparency, and strengthen compliance. It was a game changer, a tool that would redefine the way trusts were managed. As Bidzil delved deeper into the world of trust law, he began to understand the true potential of the Syntactical Trust. It was not just a tool, it was a paradigm shift, a new way of thinking about trust administration. And it was just the beginning.
Testing.
testing. Hoping I'm coming in loud and clear. This particular aspect of trustee training, compliance officer training, we technically want to make sure that everybody really understands how all this stuff really goes. So without further ado, let me give you the ground rules. Compliance officer training is tethered to syntactical trust training and implementation. And since the dawn of introducing this AI, which is we will label as ChatGPT, it has given us an edge. But a lot of individuals really don't understand how this edge can be implemented. Those of you that are in our Bittrex space, you've had access to information for the last like month or so, 2 months for those that have been in the new Bittrex space. A lot of you guys who are tuning in for the first time, you're really getting into the information, the various different platforms. And remember, I'm on over about 10 to 15 different platforms. I'm using these centrally 2 to 3 to kind of drive home a point. But there's a vast array of information that tethers around asymmetric information, the ability to convey as a compliance officer, and utilizing the syntactical trust and assistance with AI to get a lot of these things done, which requires a certain level or mental aptitude, if you will. So what I'll attempt to do in this particular course is allow those that have questions to ask those questions. There will be a Q&A session. I'll call you in by the last 4 digits of your number. Then you're able to ask your questions, and we can kind of see if we can chop it up and build it up. But in the meantime, between time, it's understanding that all things that we're dealing with, they have its place. And syntactical trust is one of the over 90 different types of trust that are used to provide true asset protection. But like we always say, in order for us to know where you're going, you first got to know where you came from. So I want you to sit back, relax, and hopefully learn something. I'm going to go back to an old not really old. It's going to be old for the older guys. A particular podcast that was given by Miss Lynette Zane, and it's entitled Global Reset Central Bank. And it was a Q&A session that she launched with Mr. Griffin, Eric Griffin, you know, the author of the book, The Creature of Jekyll Island, the one that gave you all the insides in terms of how the Federal Reserve got started. Keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you'll learn something.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our Wednesday Q&A. I'm Eric Griffin, president of ITM Trading. With me, I have Lynette Zhang, our chief market analyst.
Hey guys.
For those of you who don't know, we're tuning in for the first time. We take your questions that you submit to us via email to questions@itmtrading.com, put them up here on the screen, ask them live so you get a real, true, organic response. But before we do that,
yes,
we wanted to share something with you, and I'll have Lynette read it to you. This is really cute and cool.
It's very cute and cool and actually gives me a lot of hope. So I wanted to read this on air. And it says, Dear Lynette.
Well, hold on. It's Emily and Cheese. How old? Or does she say it in the letter?
She says it in
letter. Okay.
And I'm not going to say the last name.
Okay.
But my name is Emily Catherine. I'm 10 years old. Me and my parents like your videos. I have my own tiny gold bar and some silver coins. Good job, Emily. I love your background of books. So that's at the other studio at the house. I'm a book nerd. Do you have any advice for a 10-year-old who wants to make enough money in the future to be free? My mom has a gold ring, a copper bracelet that protects us from 5G, and a silver merry-go-round necklace that actually spins. It's awesome. Will you do financial videos for kids? Hope I hear back, Emily. So, Emily, you are off to a great start. And just take note of your mailbox. You'll see a little something in the mail. But doing videos for kids on these financial issues to help understand, you know, we've talked about it for a long time, and it's actually something that I really want to do. So maybe this is just the inspiration to start doing that, like, sooner than later. So thank you very, very much, Emily. I really appreciate it. And, you know, the advice is just as you can, gold and silver in any form. So that beautiful merry-go-round necklace, that silver is monetary at its base. And if you can find some silver coins, like, actually, you know what might be a good idea? I used to have a client who would go to the bank and get a roll of dimes and quarters and half dollars. Mm-hmm. And at night, he would go through them, and he would find, you know, one or two or three or however many he would find. And then he'd roll them back up, take them to the bank, and get another roll. And maybe that's something that you could do, Emily, and start to accumulate that way.
Yeah,
and also,
it's free.
Exactly. It's free.
You basically get, you know, if you get $10 roll, you go look through them all, and if there's a couple of dimes in there, you take them out, and you put them back, and you give them back to the bank, and they give you back $9.80.
Well, that, or you just put two more dimes in there.
Yeah, you can do that too.
You know, that are the new dimes. And you know what I used to do when I was your age? Well, my father was a developer, so it was easy for me to do this, but I would go down to his job sites, and there would be scrap copper from the copper wiring all over the place, and I would collect it, and then at night, I would whittle off the plastic.
You were doing that when you were a little kid?
Oh, heck yes, I was. Are you kidding me?
That's awesome.
100%. And I would whittle that off. He didn't like it when I took a whole roll, though.
Yeah, because it was still usable. That's so funny. You were taking usable copper.
Right.
That's awesome.
Well, I mean, I thought it was a scrap.
Yeah.
But then I had an uncle that was a junk dealer. Right. I had an uncle that was a junk dealer, and I would go and I would sell it to him by weight. And then I would go to my uncle that was the antique dealer, and I would buy stuff. So, you know, I think it's great to see this kind of thought and ambition and
for
everything,
sure. I love
you
it.
Know, and it gives me a lot of hope, because you are the hope for us, Emily, honest to goodness. And yes, I will, I promise, and I'll let you know before it goes on too. So we will keep this letter and check your mail. We'll get something special out to you for it, because I can't even tell you how much this means to me, really.
That's awesome.
Good job. Thank you so much.
All right. So John M. asks, how can the government base the reset?
You can't answer anything after this letter. I'm so moved by it, really. I'm so moved by it. Okay.
All right. That's it for
today. I'll collect myself. I know. I'll collect myself. Okay.
All right. So John M. asks, how can the government base the reset against gold and silver when there is no way to verify how much is melted every year?
It doesn't matter whether or not it's melted. And they do the reset against gold because gold is indestructible. And we can account for about 98% of all of the gold that has ever been mined. We can also account for, I'm not saying that there might not be a surprise of store of gold somewhere in the ground, but we know pretty much all of the gold that's left to be mined. So it has no way, in no way, shape, or form does it matter how much is melted every year. What really matters is they're also going to look at it based on the presumed gold that they hold in deep storage. The only thing that we don't know is what that cover ratio is going to be, and therefore, in terms of the fiat dollar, how high that will go. But what we do know is the more debt, which is a proxy for how much currency, fiat money, is out there, that is a known. It's hard. You've got to gather it. If you really want to get specific, it's not like you can just go one place and get all that information. But we know how much debt is created each year. We know how much gold there is in the world. We know how much gold central banks say that they're holding. And that's how they'll determine the fiat money price of the gold during a reset.
Well, and wouldn't it totally be based upon how much gold each country would have?
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So,
we know how much gold the central banks say
right.
that they have. Yes.
Right.
So it's not going to be based on the gold, you know, like in my ring
right.
or something
all
like that.
All the gold in existence.
Right.
How much gold does your government have to reset gold against?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Although when we're looking at the fundamental value, so how much is gold really worth, its true value, in that case, it's just frankly easier to look at how much gold exists in the world.
Yeah.
Whether it's in the ground or above the ground. And that's why I always say that number is actually really conservative.
All right. So Peter J. asks, I have heard you say to take your money out of the system. If I put it into gold and silver and then sell it down the line, it will still be in monetary form. Am I missing something?
No, you're not. But what gold and silver will do outside of the system is it will protect your purchasing power, which is what it's done for 6,000 years. And I know, Peter, that you've also heard me say that you can always convert your gold and silver into any currency and therefore any good or any service. So if you need to barter and buy something, then you will either be able to in the future possibly do it directly, so you're not going to convert the gold and silver. You're going to use that as a tool of barter. Or, like, say, property taxes, for example, well, you're not going to take the gold or the silver to the bank. You're going to have to convert it into whatever the currency is at that time, and then you're going to immediately spend it. So, no, you're absolutely right. But what I can also tell you is that for me, because of what I see happening and even into the future with central bank digital currencies, where they can directly control the immediate value, you know, by going into negative rates or something like that, that I intend to hold back. Like I would have. In my original plan, I would have converted a lot more into the new currency once we were done, once I was certain that there was a component of gold in the new currency and therefore it would hold its value more. But since I see what they're doing with the CBDCs, and while I do think they're still going to do that because that's what history tells us, and also they're going to gain public confidence again, I'm going to be withholding a lot more gold than I would have in my original strategy. And I'll convert it as I need it, but not before I need it.
So the Fred J. question that was coming up right here, kind of that one goes right into this perfectly. It's almost
okay.
as though you saw the question.
I didn't.
Is it correct to say
actually,
that gold retains its value against any currency because it
Failing
is ultimately...
currency. Now I can read it.
Oh, I missed an important word there.
Yeah.
Is it correct to say that gold retains its value against any failing currency because it is ultimately convertible to some other existing currency that is stable? So I'll ask you part two after that.
Okay. Well, not because it is ultimately convertible, but because gold retains its value because it has the greatest level of functionality of any asset. And because it is indestructible and has the broadest base of buyer. So that's key. You never really hear anybody on Wall Street talk about that. But if you want to sell something, if you want to liquidate something and you have one buyer or you have zero buyers, that's what happens when a market implodes or when a currency collapses. There's no buyers for that currency. So, but with gold, because it is used in every single area of the global economy, you have global buyers all over the world. You have the broadest base of buyer. Does that make sense?
Well, I think what you're trying to say is that there's always demand.
Correct. Exactly.
Because of the usefulness of it, there is always demand.
Exactly. Thank you. But you can always, other currency that is stable, you tell me what fiat currency is stable out there right now.
So this, he was asking that question kind of lead into, so what if we get into a situation where there is a future single global currency, like let's call it the SDR, one currency.
Okay.
And it fails,
thereby
having gold has no alternative to value it against. So then does it lose value, essentially?
It does not lose value because gold's value is not using it against another currency that fails. It's because of that broad-based demand. That's really why gold retains its value.
And it is the one true money. Even though we've been trained to feel like it isn't, it is the one true money for thousands of years. So it always has value because of the demand. People always want it.
Right. And I mean, for the Bank of International Settlements, and understand who these people are, they are the central bank's central bank. They are the single most powerful bank in the world. And for them to list off all of these properties about gold, it's no wonder that global central banks are accumulating it, or presumably, even if they're not accumulating it, like the U.S. hasn't changed even a steenth of an ounce since, I think, 52, that they say that they're holding it. You know, I mean, there are some countries that have gotten rid of it, like Canada. I don't think that's a very smart thing for them to do. But most all other central banks are holding it because they want to retain control when their fiat currencies fail. And they want to retain confidence so that those that got us into this mess can retain power. That's what gold is. It's going to give you choices. It's going to give you power. But what did the biz say? You know, it has proven itself in adverse circumstance. Do you think we're in adverse circumstance and you think it's going to get worse? If you think everything is hunky-dory and it's going to stay great, you know, it preserves, it is really an insurance policy against inflation, which robs you of your purchasing power by design. And, you know, really, my favorite, this isn't my favorite, I'll tell you my favorite, I'll do this one. It is the only, according to the Bank for International Settlements, financial asset that runs zero counterparty risk. The only one. And in this world, you want counterparty risk or do you not want counterparty risk? That's your choice. But my favorite is when they actually said, gold held at home runs no political risk.
Yeah.
Voila. Hold it, own it.
What's interesting is, though, that's not like mainstream, right, for the most part. It's hidden. It's like, oh, no, digital currency is the best.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, look at how convenient it is.
Train us out of believing that gold is real money.
Right, right.
All right, Jesse L. asks, are index funds safe during a reset scenario or even with a declining currency or move to a central bank digital currency? Are index funds safe?
No, that's a fiat money product, and it's going to reflect the value of the fiat money. So you can have $1 trillion worth of index funds, but if you can't buy anything with that money, you tell me what good it is. Trillion times zero. Look in Zimbabwe. They've got billionaires that can't buy an egg.
JR asks, when they reset the currency, what does this do to the United States and its role as the world reserve currency?
Well, you know, honestly, we've been slowly, I mean, in 1971, before we did the reset, we had made an attempt to give that role back. But quite honestly, we're losing that role, and we've been for a while. What has saved us is that because so many countries use the dollar in trade, and it still does have the lion's share, and we have supposedly, or at least in the past, the most deeply liquid markets, particularly with the 10-year treasury, with the treasuries. You know, that's why we have kind of sort of retained that position. But in reality, it was already in 2002 that there were not enough buyers of our debt, and the Federal Reserve had started to buy up government debt. And that is a way to subsidize government spending. And that was already back in 2002. I remember the euro was created to take over as the world reserve currency. I don't think it's going to be the euro. I don't think it's going to be the U.S. dollar. I think the one, and I don't think it's going to be the Chinese yuan. Because when it's one single currency in one single country, then it really requires a great deal of deficits to, we've seen how that's worked. It doesn't work very well. What makes the most sense to me, and we'll see, there's no guarantee about this, is the SDR, because that is a basket of fiat currencies. So I see us having one overall world reserve currency, the SDR, and then local currencies. The U.S. will have the U.S. dollar, and, you know, the Chinese will have the yuan, and those will be in digital form. But I think it'll probably be the SDR. Makes the most sense to me. They have the mechanisms. And remember, too, I don't know if I'm talking about this question or another one, but when you're talking about the world reserve currency, remember the IMF, International Monetary Fund, set up a substitution fund so that if you're sitting and you're holding dollars or dollar-denominated instruments, you just deposit them into the substitution fund, and the IMF converts them into SDRs, whether it's an SDR bond or whatever. And I know the IMF has been working diligently. I don't know how successful it's being yet, but they're trying to create that market so that they can take over as the world reserve currency. So SDR bonds, SDR trading, and, you know, all of the other fiat games and garbage.
And a little out of breath there.
Well, I'm telling you, you know, when I see these things and I think about the IMF, and I just, there is so much information, there are so many changes, and the whole world is so fragile and vulnerable. I have been feeling extraordinarily anxious. And I've been really rushing to get done whatever it is that I have to get done at my bug out house. And I'm very grateful that I have that, because I do feel safe when I'm there.
That's good.
Yeah.
So we'll ask, scroll up there, Edgar, for me for a second. Oh, we don't know who asked that question, huh?
A lot of people ask,
what are your thoughts on buying platinum?
Well, platinum is a precious metal. Russia does control that market, and it's very beautiful, but it is not a monetary metal. So you can certainly buy it if you want. It's going to hold value. It's very rare. It's more rare than gold. And it makes beautiful jewelry, so I have some platinum. And at one point, because platinum used to be more expensive than gold, and then it flip-flopped. And so I actually bought some platinum a while ago for that reason, and it's remained flip-flopped. So you can buy platinum, but that is not a monetary metal.
So it's not something that you buy on a regular basis
for
what you're trying to accomplish.
Correct.
Well, I'm getting points of clarification because our audience will ask.
And that is why I like you here, actually. I think that's good. But you know what I buy.
Yes, I do.
Do you buy platinum?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I know, but I just figured that, you know.
But I do have some platinum
know.
Jewelry, which I'm not wearing any today. But I do have some jewelry, platinum jewelry.
Yeah, well, and it's like we always say, too. You can. There's a lot of things out there in the world that you can invest in. As long as you have your gold and silver insurance policy in place, you can buy whatever you want to speculate on.
Yeah, exactly.
Edgar M. asks, do you think CBDCs will be the answer to the U.S. debt and inflation?
Nope. I think it'll be the next stage in that, because then it gives them a lot more control over
so
the public.
Control.
But the CBDC is programmable money. And yes, of course, well, let's see, why would governments and central banks not want programmable money? And they're on the race because the private market's already created, you know, the cryptocurrencies. But no, I 100% no, it will not be the answer. How can it be the
answer? Coming in loud and clear. Hopefully everybody can hear me. Hopefully I'm coming in loud and clear. Hopefully everybody can hear me. Hopefully I'm coming in loud and clear. And everybody can hear me. I'm going to make sure before I begin that somebody let me know that I can be heard. Somebody text me, let me know that my audio is coming in loud and clear. Let me know that I'm coming in loud and clear. All right, good deal. With that being said, let's say for laughs and giggles, 99% of the listeners, because this is an old, when I say old, this is over a year old that I just played for you. We're going to say that the majority of the individuals a year and a half ago did not know how close we were to implementing these new banking functionalities. So as compliance officers, the recent bank failures have increased our revenue by what? 300%. There's a 300% rate of return if you knew half of what Lynette was just talking about. That information that you had then, applying it now, if you compare a snapshot of your financials in 2022, and we're going to say Q1 of 2022, and you compare them to the financial forecast for today, you should be on par to earn 300% more than what you earned then. Just by knowing that information and understanding the fundamentals that put you into that position. Now, I'm back into compliance officer training because this is syntactical trust implementation through AI. The content we're discussing is compliance officer training is focusing on the use of insurance policies to as collateral for loans under the Uniform Commercial Code UCC 9-102 subsection A-47. Again, that is UCC 9-102 subsection A-47. So it is understanding that if you incorporate UCC 9-102 subsection A-47 in your loan documentation, you're able to monetize insurance policies and use those policies as collateral. There's a reason why you're allowed to do that in standardized debt obligations. And the AI technology, because we are already into current expected credit loss implementation, allows that data to be captured by automated underwriting software. This is why you are in this class. Highlights of this content covers compliance officer training using insurance policies collateral for loans. We talk about insurance policies can be pledged as securities for a loan. It's used to reduce the risk at default. You can provide a written security agreement, which is required to establish a lender's right to the insurance policy as collateral. Proper identification of the insurance policy and insurer is critical for validity. Filing a financing statement, which is a UCC-1, in accordance with Article 9, is necessary to perfect and establish priority of the security interest. We also are going to discuss priority risk for competing security interests depending upon the order of the perfection and the state laws. We also going to talk about the advantages of using insurance policies as collateral, including the ease of obtaining, which includes low costs and potential tax benefits. But we also going to talk about the disadvantages, which includes limited borrowing capacity, risk of policy lapsing, and the complexities in enforcement. And then last but not least, all compliance officers must understand that your UCC that you use is UCC 9-102, subsection A-47, and that all state laws are to be navigated through this process to be effective. Now that I laid the groundwork, now that I've given you why you're here, now that I've told you exactly what all this is about, everything that you are studying, everything is in a position where you can typically implement. I want you to really focus on the ability to monetize. Let's say everyone in the private who understands UCC 9-102, subsection A, 47, they acknowledge they are using that provision to take a third party who has provided a surety document. They're using that policy as collateral to reduce their debt-to-income ratio. Let's just say that's your move. That's what you're doing. So if that is the position, that means that that life insurance policy, that general liability policy, these policies that you have acquired when you properly substantiate this information can be used to reduce debt-to-income ratio. Now, if you reduce the debt-to-income ratio, doesn't that increase your chances of getting more of a loan to securitize the business? As compliance officers, This is the root of syntactical trust implementation, because only through a syntactical trust using AI, you're able to do this instantly. Everywhere else, you're going to have to see it, create it, substantiate it. And all you guys already know that you're supposed to substantiate before you transact. Are we clear? Hopefully we are. I will give you a chance to ask certain questions. We do have a chat that's actually open in this forum, so if you actually go directly to the link, and if you want to ask a question in the chat, I will. You guys have access to me. You can send me a text message. I'll bring it up directly inside the class. I'll answer the questions that way as well. But I want to make sure that everybody, and I mean everybody, comprehends why we're here and what we're supposed to be doing. Next, since we already got our feet wet and we kind of know what we need to know, let's talk about K-1 disbursements. Now, we're going to talk about funding a trust with a K-1. Keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you'll learn something.
Funding a trust using a K-1 disbursement, a comprehensive guide for compliance officers. Introduction. A definition of a trust. A trust is a fiduciary relationship in which a party, known as a trustor, gives another party, the trustee, the right to hold title to property or assets for the benefit of a third party, the beneficiary. B. Overview of a K-1 disbursement. A K-1 disbursement is a financial distribution from a business entity, such as a partnership or an S corporation, to its owners or partners. It is reported on Schedule K-1 for tax purposes. C. Purpose of funding a trust. The primary purpose of funding a trust is to manage and protect assets, avoid probate, provide for beneficiaries, and potentially reduce estate taxes. 2. Understanding trust funding. A. Importance of funding a trust. Funding a trust is crucial, as an unfunded or partially funded trust can lead to complications and may not effectively carry out the trustor's intentions. B. Types of assets that can be funded into a trust. Various types of assets can be funded into a trust, including real estate, bank accounts, non-retirement investment accounts, life insurance policies, and business interests. C. Benefits of funding a trust. Benefits include avoiding probate, maintaining privacy, managing assets during incapacity, and potentially reducing estate taxes. 3. Overview of K-1 disbursement. A. Importance of K-1 disbursement. K-1 disbursements are important as they represent a significant source of income for many trusts. B. Types of assets that can be funded into a trust using K-1 disbursement. Primarily, business interests and income from partnerships or S-corporations can be funded into a trust using K-1 disbursements. C. Benefits of funding a trust using K-1 disbursement. This method allows for the efficient transfer of business income and interests into a trust, providing a mechanism for managing and protecting these assets. 4. Process of funding a trust using a K-1 disbursement. A. Reviewing the trust agreement. The trust agreement should be thoroughly reviewed to understand the terms and conditions related to funding the trust. B. Identifying the trustee and beneficiaries. The trustee and beneficiaries should be clearly identified to ensure a proper distribution of the K-1 disbursement. Determining the amount of the K-1 disbursement. The amount of the disbursement should be determined based on the trust agreement and the financial situation of the entity issuing the K-1. D. Ensuring compliance with tax laws and regulations. It is crucial to ensure that the disbursement and subsequent funding of the trust comply with all relevant tax laws and regulations. E. Communicating with the entity issuing the K-1 disbursement. Open and clear communication with the entity issuing the disbursement is necessary to facilitate the process. F. Documenting the transfer of the disbursement into the trust. Proper documentation is essential for legal and tax purposes. G. Updating the trust's financial records. The trust's financial records should be updated to reflect the new assets. V. Potential challenges and considerations. A. Coordination with tax professionals. Coordination with tax professionals is necessary to ensure proper tax treatment of the disbursement and the trust. B. Timing and frequency of K-1 disbursements. The timing and frequency of disbursements can impact the trust's cash flow and tax situation. C. Tracking and managing trust assets. Proper tracking and management of trust assets are crucial for maintaining the trust's value and purpose. D. Compliance with trust agreement and applicable laws. Compliance with the trust agreement and all applicable laws is necessary to avoid legal complications. 6. Monitoring and managing trust assets. A. Regular review of trust assets. Regular reviews of trust assets are necessary to ensure they are being managed effectively. B. Periodic reassessment of funding strategy. The funding strategy should be reassessed periodically to ensure it remains appropriate given the trust's goals and the financial situation of the entity issuing the K-1. C. Proper documentation and record keeping. Maintaining proper documentation and records is crucial for legal and tax purposes. D. Communication with trustees and beneficiaries. Regular communication with trustees and beneficiaries can help ensure the trust is functioning as intended. 7. Conclusion. Cap of the importance of funding a trust. Funding a trust is crucial for managing and protecting assets, providing for beneficiaries, and potentially reducing estate taxes. B. Reminder to seek professional advice. Given the complexity of trust funding and tax laws, it is advisable to seek professional advice. C. Emphasize the ongoing management and review of trust assets. Regular management and review of trust assets are necessary to ensure the trust continues to serve its intended purpose.
All right. Hopefully you guys learned something. Hopefully this information isn't just going on deaf ears. Hopefully everybody's taking notes. Yes, the recording will be made available. All I'm saying is there's a lot of work to do in a short time to get there. So please use your cheat sheets. Use this AI. Do not be afraid of it. Tell you why. If you are a notary acting in that capacity, meaning that if you are a notary that either has grandfathered into this by going through the American Arbitration Association's training that we provide, and then getting your 690 hours as an apprenticeship, meaning you're listening to the various different podcasts and broadcasts and participating in this class, you have joined the world's oldest legal profession, the oldest legal guild on the planet. Before there were judges and lawyers, there were always scribes and notaries. And so when you're in that position and you know what you're doing, look at the fact that notaries in Europe, the only way they can become a notary is someone has to die and there has to be an election and an appointment. Because, and some of the notaries that are actually in this training can testify to that. I will share with you a platform where if you can record it in your journal in 24 hours, an international notary can monetize it. Because over there, they're under a certain aspect of uniform commercial code. Here in the United States, where it was done in one capacity, it simply broke the profession up. But again, it's asymmetric information, and a lot of notaries are being recruited by banks and lending institutions, but not really fully understanding their potential and power. Because if you knew you was the money, then why are you going outside of yourself to get value? And for that matter, if you know you are the money, why do you need to go outside of yourself to convey that value? The same way you go on your job and you give them your time, which is priceless. You can't put a value on time, but you give your time in exchange for paper. And that's, last time I checked, isn't quid pro quo. Quid pro quo is something of, something for something of equal exchange. How can paper be equal to something that's priceless? So you sell yourself into slavery. You sell yourself into servitude. It is so easy to let somebody else do all this accounting and reading and articulating. Mr. Bay, I just want what I want. I don't want to do no work for it. Well, that sounds like a beneficiary, and a beneficiary in that capacity sounds like you're on the bus. The bus driver is telling you, look, young blood, you ain't going to tell me which way I need to turn when I'm driving the bus. If you don't like the way I'm driving, young blood, pull the string, get off. See, everybody in commerce is expected to be an expert. And just because you're not, ignorance of that don't give you no excuse. You're just going to be governed accordingly. So as compliance officers, there's a whole lot of work to do to correct the records. See, M3 conveyances are allowed globally around the world, even in the territory that you call the Americas or the United States of America. It's just they cannot tell a citizen to participate in that arena. Matter of fact, if you are a citizen, that literally disqualifies you from participating in notional pooling, because that's what they do. Through their corporate fictions and trust agreements and various different things, they utilize that space. So it's only a secret to you. They gave you social media, and what did you do? You became social with it. And socialism is the opposite of privacy. So if you're using these social tools and they are expecting privacy, good luck with that. I'm here to save the savable. Those of you that have signed on to become compliance officers, that becomes your burden now, save the savable. It's not about trying to convince anyone of what they already know. Again, if you wasn't taught this in public school, and now that you're getting this information, you still don't want it, shake off your sandal, move on to the next person. Look, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. Creditors got to have debtors. I know it's hard, but it's fair. It is what it is. At the end of the day, we want you to understand, and I'm going to stop using the word understand, and comprehend that the AI is not designed to replace you, but it will if you don't resonate to a higher frequency and a different level of implementation. Those of you that are inside of the Diversity Trust limited space, I think Jarvis is the only one that actually has taken his, it was sent out to him. The algorithm went ahead and sent him his Python script for banking in the box, the new algorithm. Yeah, there's been 4 renditions since ChatGPT has come out. And it should be a zip file. I think Jarvis already has it in his space. some of you guys. It depends on, and it, what it does, it checks to see how often you're interacting with the classes also. So if you ain't got it yet, you need to get your algorithm up because maybe you don't have enough hours in. Once you get a certain amount of hours, the AI will send you a zip folder, which is a Python script to write the algorithm into your PDFs. In other words, when there's a certain type of encryption that you can use with your PDFs and your Word docs. So when you use them, they're carrying with it that value. That's a different conversation, but since this is syntactical trust training, we have to touch it. How can one leverage this information? Well, automated underwriting software is tethered to government underwriting software. For example, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and those entities alike, if this is a government-funded loan program, then they're using GUS, AUS, automated underwriting software communicates with those platforms. So let's team it up. A 1003 is on the DTC side of the security settlement system. Value that's coming from that standardized debt obligation that has been monetized by automated underwriting software is given a credit / debit on the DT side of the security settlement system. The fiduciary, the trustee, determines the method of conveyance. So the settler is going to write instructions from the trust on how it goes into the DTC. The trustee is going to determine how it comes out. Hopefully you guys are getting this. Hopefully you guys are taking notes. Hopefully, within the next 24 to 48 hours, if you're not in the Diversity Trust Holdings or Diversity Limited, Trust Limited Bittrex space, because we constantly discuss these types of implementations. You're not going to get this in Apex Capital. But if you're in Page and if you're in Legal Jacks, because, yes, Legal Jacks does have a Bittrex space, you're going to get this information. So if you're not in these Bittrex spaces, what I'm saying to you may sound foreign. You need to get with fiduciaries that are in those spaces, because a lot of these fiduciaries have purchased manuals and data sets that can take what you're trying to articulate and monetize and utilize that. I constantly, in all the spaces, put out the fact that if you're communicating with me in Bittrex, I already have the Banking in the Box platform up, ready to syntax whatever you send to me back. A lot of individuals just call me on a humbug, so to speak, and they want to talk their way into a transaction. And then I constantly have to stop because I'm trying to figure out, well, who the hell are you in the transaction? Because it sounds like you're all over the place. Now, when you're saying, okay, well, in accordance with this, da-da-da-da, now you're speaking my language. But again, for the new people, I understand what you're saying. I understand where you're going. But I spend a tremendous amount of time in neutral because I'm trying to figure out, do you know who you are in the transaction? And if this is accounting and you ain't substantiating what you're talking about, you know, I'm tapping the mic. You know, is this Memorex? You know, are you trying to trick me? Are you an agent? What are you doing? Of course you can't commingle. How in the hell are you going to ask me, can you commingle on this phone? Are you crazy? So what do? I respond with the question. Well, who are you in the transaction? Now, if you want to do it, do it. Yeah, that ain't the answer that you wanted. I'm just a messenger. Accounting is simple when you understand that whatever you do on one side of the ledger is an even opposite on the other side. The AI simply helps you move it faster. But you're only as good as the tools in your toolbox. Those of you that do construction work, you know, you can hang up a painting with a shoe. you know, you can technically take out a shoe and hang up a painting, right? Might take all day, might mess up the shoe, because the shoe wasn't designed to hang up paintings. You got a perfectly good hammer in there. But if you keep wanting to use shoes, who am I to tell you not to use a shoe? You might like using shoes. I just have to point out the fact that you do know there's a hammer over there that does it faster and easier. Oh, I don't want to do that. You know, I got to figure that out. I'd rather take the shoe. Okay, well, you know, knock yourself out. Use the shoe. Case in point, the entire commercial system is tethered to codes. Articulate codes in this format. It minimally needs to be a 9-digit identifier associated with the credit or debit. So there needs to be a credit or debit associated with a 9-digit identifier. You got that. We got a placeholder for value. And because it's a credit or debit, we know whether it's going to increase the balance sheet or decrease the balance sheet. Now, the way to do it is a million and one ways. Use the AI to design a very special roadmap specifically for that transaction. Now, again, in this particular space, because this is Blog Talk, I return back to my roots. This is where I got my start at. When the world did not know anything about Bazelle until I went to the Richard Butner Show, and by the help of my marketing director, V-Dub, a.k.a. Valencia Sims, we used to talk about conveyances for 2 hours straight to 300-plus listeners 7 days a week. I didn't know that people were really paying attention. I just thought that everybody that was in the accounting space just needed a reminder of recapture recovery. This is the other side of this that I don't talk about a lot in the news spaces, but I got to bring you back. In order for you to know where you're going, you got to know where you came from. Let's talk about recapture recovery. The entire security settlement system has taken every application that has gone through automated underwriting software, and they have recreated it in paper format. But when they created it in paper format, it's now considered commercial paper. So now this commercial paper can be conveyed, reconveyed, repetitioned, remixed, and monetized over and over and over again, as long as there is a what? A credit or debit attached to a 9-digit identifier. So you'll have an institution that starts out as ABC Company, then it becomes ABC Corp, then it becomes ABC LLC. It becomes LLC, da-da-da-da-da, woo-woo-woo, the name game. But as long as there's a number and a 9-digit identifier, value can be conveyed. If you understand, because I'm going to go back to a legal maxim that I read in all arbitration cases, which brings this back into your toolbox. We'll start here on legal maxim number 6 that I read during arbitration. Guaranteed, all men shall have a remedy by due course of law. And if the remedy does not exist, or if the existing remedy has been subverted, then one may create a remedy for themselves and endow it with credibility by expressing it in their what? Affidavit. Why? Because ignorance of the law might be an excuse, but it is not a valid reason for the commission of a crime when law is easily and readily available to anyone, anyone making a reasonable effort to study the law. If you are a civil law notary / compliance officer, what is the saying? You're either worthy to learn or worthy to serve. And if you're showing up as a compliance officer, you're worthy to learn. You're worthy to teach. You're worthy to implement. You are allowed these allowances for doubtful accounts. So all what you did in the past can be repetitioned in another commercial ledger to reappreciate, revalue, recapitalize the estate. This affidavit isn't just for your award and then you go put it back where you got it. If you don't do anything else and you have gone through arbitration, pull out your affidavit of commerce and study it. If you really want to see some magic, copy and paste it in the ChatGPT and make that your foundation for conveyances. I think I said enough. I'm going to open up the floor for questions now. I do have some more content to bring forth, but again, I do not like to go too far into what's being done unless we're getting a certain level of comprehension. So what I'm going to do from the top to the bottom is I'm going to call your number. Last four digits give you an opportunity to ask your questions. Again, I'm going to go down the line. I'm going to call the last four digits of your phone number. Now, I got one person, I think I know who they is, that's got the last four digits 1111. So when I call that number, I think they know who they is. So just be ready. But I'm going to go down the line. I'm going to give everybody a chance to ask questions. Matter of fact, I'm going to bring you on, starting from the top. I have a caller whose last four digits of their number, their phone number, they're showing up in this queue as 2239. Caller 2239. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns about anything we talked about up until this point.
It's interesting.
I'm here.
The you call it notice of conveyance.
Right.
Are you listening? A notice of conveyance is like affidavit notice of conveyance. That's something that would be able to discuss about what's your intake as far as affidavit of truth.
Right. Like, for example, the notice, let's call it what it is in commerce. Whenever we take a subject matter and place it in the format of commerce, now affidavits take on a whole nother bulletproof proponent. They kind of become the vehicle. Like if I'm saying that you've issued me a tax credit of $1 million and this was done on this date and I recorded on a UCC-1 and conveyed it through a UCC-3. Now I make that information public. The only way that information can be rebutted is with a what? A commercial affidavit. Not somebody calling in saying, that's not what happened. You're going to respond in the form of an affidavit because that's the only way it can be rebutted. Failure to do so constitutes truth because in commerce, only affidavits are looked at as notices of conveyance. So keep going.
Yeah, that's interesting. So at this point, notice of conveyance to answer in a court of law is a platform for you to present yourself, presentment?
Correct. Correct. It is a very, when you have a knowledgeable civil law notary and they witness facts in commerce, their witnessing of facts becomes not only a attestation, they also jurat what they're witnessing. See, most notaries in the public don't do attestation. They're just juratting. And juratting just saying, you signed this document in front of me. Attesting is the documentation is valid. So this is why you got to be careful when you're using public notaries because nobody in the public wants to be liable for nobody. So a public notary is going to say, I don't give a darn what's in this document. I'm just witnessing you signing it. The end. Since you brought it up, every notary that can't produce his or her journal, but you send me a court document that was notarized and I ask for the minutes and you can't produce it, I have overturned every single one of those notices. Why? Not because I'm special. It's because commerce has fundamental principles.
Mm-hmm.
So it is the ultimate placeholder. You can't skip that step and then come back to it because you came to one of my classes. What I'm trying to get you to say is that what I did was outside of law, so it's to be considered not done. So now I get to start over. See how I said that? I said the exact same thing the right way. In commerce, if it was done outside of law, you're supposed to act as if it wasn't done. You follow me? Not yeah. argue. You as if you are competent like you trying to tell me you are, you have to know that they did that outside of law. So as a fiduciary who wants to be fully responsible, I'm supposed to consider that act that's being done outside of law as not being done. So now I get to be fair. I'm going to give everybody a chance to what? Get their books right, to balance the books. So I'm not just doing a remedy for home team and leaving everybody out to dry. If I provide lawful legal money for the home team, I got to provide lawful legal money for the other team. You cannot move in this process the right way of how we're explaining it if you first don't forgive those that trespassed against your estate. You can't go using lawful legal money if you haven't forgiven those that trespassed against you. And that's a tough pill to swallow when everybody's emotional, because you'll be emotionally correct, commercially wrong.
Okay.
Keep going. I know you got some more questions.
So, yeah, the, 1 second, let me see, let me get
uh-huh.
my words.
Okay.
As far as,
don't be nervous. Don't be nervous.
Questioning authority, that will be considered what, in this case, a questioning authority to the court. Questioning jurisdiction, that will set forth what? That's a conveyance?
Okay. Here's how I want you to think about in commerce. It's not what you say that determines who you are, it's what you do. So you telling me you are this, that, and the third means nothing. It's your actions. So if you are who you say you are, I'm going to engage you from a fundamental perspective. Let's just say, criminally, you're making some sort of statement. I know you're not allowed as a public official to make unbonded statements. So when you say what you're saying, I raise my hand. Let me see if I'm understanding or comprehending what you're asking. When you say that what was done commercially was illegal, you're technically saying that it was non-taxable. Am I correct?
Yes.
When you say that this was done legally, you're technically saying that this is actually a taxable transaction. Am I correct? You see how I'm responding with questions?
With questions.
Creditors
so
always respond with questions.
Okay.
The minute they can compel you to say, this ain't my dope, it's done. All they going to do is sit there and let you plead your case, hoop and holler and scream. They're going to be like, all right, you're done now, right? Okay, now that you're done, they're going to ask you, do you understand what you're being charged with? And you're going to say, yes, sir. And then they're going to slam the gavel and send you down the road because they have to. They didn't send you down the road. You sent yourself down the road. They want to know what on earth compels an innocent man to testify against his goddamn self. Are you on any drugs? You said, you know, this is, they're giving you a practical examination. This is why I am sticking to, it's not personal, it's business. They have a right to protect their belongings. And when I show up saying I'm brown and I got a light-skinned girlfriend and I got a black car and a black leather coat, and I'm thinking because I'm identifying myself with colors that I'm going to get some sort of remedy, okay, good luck with that. So creditors always respond with questions. It conflicts a lot of debtors because they want to do what I hear all the time. Mr. Bay, I want to do the right thing. Okay. In commerce, why, when you are asked to give sworn testimony, what hand do they tell you to put on the Bible?
Right.
Have you ever seen a lawyer ever swear himself in or get sworn in? You ever seen a lawyer? Matter of fact, y'all remember the press conference with the U.S. Attorney General? Remember when he was on the stand? What hand did he swear in on? He did it in front of the whole world during COVID. We had a whole class about that. You probably wasn't around at that time. But what hand did he swear in on? Y'all don't remember, right? Let me tell you.
The left?
He swore in with the left hand. Now, listen to me real carefully. You are instructed to swear in with the right hand, and a public official can swear in with the left hand. What do you think's going to happen?
I mean that you convict yourself.
That means he's going to play you all the way to the left. That's why he swore in with the left. You believe that lying is illegal when it's not. It's perfectly allowable. That's why he's swearing with the left hand. He's going to lie, steal, cheat, because lying isn't illegal in commerce. Perjury is. I'll give you another example. A magistrate, like a female judge who has individuals in front of her that are male, she's trained. Because women can out-talk men. She is trained to press them buttons. Listen to this, y'all. She is trained to press your ego button. And if you so stupid, you can't put your ego in check, she's going to give you a million years because of some words that you said, how you feel. It ain't got nothing to do with the price of potatoes in Idaho. It's about how you feel. And you in prison because of how you fucking feel. Pardon my language. I'm just passionate about what I'm saying.
Yes.
They are trained to deal with people because people are what? Word controlled. I can say words right now, everybody will love me. I can say some other stuff, everybody want to kill me, because we're controlled by words. This is why having this language model, you don't got the excuse no more. All they're going to say is, well, okay, I guess this is what we're doing. They ain't going to beg you, plead with you. Let me tell you what they told me in the feds. Because, yes, I did have a federal indictment when I was on my vacation. When you go under federal custody, they finna start telling you the truth. Like, immediately, the day that gavel slammed and you get behind that wall, you finna see the devil. Ain't nobody got to tell you the devil exists. You finna see him in living color. First thing the devil told me, you think you got some sort of right when it's really a privilege. So let me explain this to you. As long as you're in this facility, we only have to give you the opportunity to eat. Did you catch that? All we got to do is make you get up, take you to the chow hall, and show you the food. We ain't got to feed you. So you got it all twisted. But see, when you be in that environment for a while, you figure it out. And the sad part about it is, even in prison, they got trustees. Every prison I ever been to always got trustees. Hell, this is a bigger prison out here than it is in there. So why in the hell ain't nobody acting like trustees out here? I get it. Social media didn't tell you that what you're supposed to be doing. You ain't read that in no book. The same book that when you graduated, you put the square on your head. That's a different lesson. Any other questions?
No. So in a case of, they say you're going to swear into, they want to swear you into this court case, instead of, we know that swearing is,
you should say,
the law,
I affirm.
So
don't do,
affirm.
When they're going to ask you, do you,
yes,
swear? I affirm. They're going to ask you, do you,
yes,
swear? I affirm.
Yes.
They got to ask you three, yes, times. If you respond three times the right way, they move on to the next question. If,
yes,
you buckle, you don't know what you're doing. You playing. You listening to Bazelle. And we already know that. We know that trick.
Yeah,
see, it ain't about what I say. It's about what you know. I'm telling you, the easiest way to get it is take whatever you have and make it your own, so no one can take it from you. They say, so a man thinketh he becomes free. It's what you know, not what I say. It's what you know. Commerce ain't never about what you say. Commerce is about your actions. Any other questions? Because I got a couple other folks that definitely want
to. From this point on, I'm supposed to be gathering the information to be able to make a presentation towards conveyance.
Right. And most of the evidence that you have can be conveyed. That's why the testimony that was given has already been articulated through that case syllabus. It's just a matter of issuing a specimen for presentment. And again, I've given everybody the last 5 days to get their stuff into the securitization audit. That's excluding you, Mr. Allen, because I've already personally taken care of what we're talking about. But I am going to be implementing in the next few days, not over the weekend because I at least need a couple of days with the family, but going into the first part of the week, I am starting those disbursements based upon those syllabuses. And I will be circling back to everyone to make sure you understand what we already know. So that come to Jesus meeting is coming.
So considering the 14th is coming up, I supposed to put a presentment to these people.
What's going to be presented before the 14th is the conveyance to do away with the case.
Okay.
Now, again, any other information that you have that we already don't have, then definitely make that available. But I think we have enough to put it to bed.
So basically, it's going to be affidavit that needs to convey what we need to put forth.
Right. Affidavits are the only responding tool that I'm going to talk about in these venues, because motions and all those things, different jurisdiction.
I see. I could see a better picture what you've been saying. It makes sense.
Right. That'll be the approach. On the 11th, I will be pretty much everybody that has made certain things known, whether it's a securitization audit, a mechanism that need to be funded, whatever the case may be, if it's already been placed inside of our website, I'm going to have all these issues settled no later than the 10th. Of this week, because on the 11th, I'm going to be out of the loop, you know, for medical reasons. So I need all these things out of the way, so when I come back, we can start fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
So,
if not,
When you were speaking about the 3Ks and the 1Ks and the K issues, those are to be considered as what?
Those are going to be methods of disbursement that's going to be done for different jurisdictions. So K1s is a certain jurisdiction, K2s is a jurisdiction, and K3s our jurisdiction. So it depends upon the institution that will receive those disbursements, what position are they in to determine whether they're getting a K-1, K-2, or K-3.
Okay. And these are considered to be what, like another exchange?
Well, there's going to be an exchange of value from one ledger to the other. It's just being done in the form of a K-1 because these institutions, if they are bonded and insured, can only receive a credit. If they can't receive a credit, they can't demand you go get them fiat. Now, guess what? If you ain't sharp and you don't understand that it's chess, not checkers, you're gonna create that liability that you're going to be held accountable to. But that's not how it starts. If they're telling you anything can and will be used against you, believe it. Have faith in it. And make sure that what you say don't be used against you. It helps you by calling things what they are. It's fundamentals. Fraud is a failure to disclose. Legal is taxable. Illegal is non-taxable. Let that be your premise, and it's real easy to articulate what you want to do. You don't have to say it like how I'm saying it. You can say, I'll do this if you do that. That's a conditional acceptance. If you do this, I'll do that. That's all it is. I just like to use big words and sound intelligent. You don't have to do that.
So articulation becomes one of the skills of the craft.
Right. That's why all of this training is based on repetitiveness. Listening over and over. Like, if you're not going to really, in my opinion, learn something until you have listened to it entirely for at least seven times to intelligently talk about it.
Interesting.
Listen to it seven times. Read it seven times. Now we can have a dialogue based upon what you are comprehending. If you read it one time, or most cases, read it no time, listen to it, half of one. Now we want to have a conversation. Well, that conversation is going to get a little weird. Like, I can't want it more than you. Like, what you need to do is simple, but it's hard because your belief and faith is somewhere else. The body goes where the mind is. If you believe that they hold your faith in their hand, then they will hold your fate in their hand. And ain't no amount of training going to change that. Your mind changes that. Your mind has to change. But definitely, Mr. Allen, I'm going to come back to you. Give me a second. I'm going to try to get everybody in. I only got like 30 more minutes before they cut the feed. So let me just move on down the line and see if I can ask couple more folks that may have some questions, and if I have time, I will come back. Caller, last four digits, your number is going to be 7260. 7260. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns over anything we discussed at this particular point.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Listen. So the first thing is, let's say I was ignorant, and I accepted my charges, and I did everything they told me to do, and I'm in the institution, and I've been there 10, 20 years, and now I realize what I've done. Is my first action to get with two civil law notaries and explain to them my testimony so that they can document it and come into arbitration?
Exactly, because what has to happen without getting into the theatrics that landed you there? You do not want the notaries to determine who dope it was or whatever. We're not there to adjudicate. We're there to arbitrate, and it's about commerce. So your testimony of who dope it was is going to be construed as somebody was damaged. This is the damage. This who needs to be paid. This who receives the K-1. That's the gist of
our show. Okay, got it. So it's really simple. So then the other, and that person has to, like us, be fully confident and understand who they are in the situation, or they're going to blow all of our precious time, right?
Right, because you got to remember, everyone that is emotional, they're right to be emotional, but it has no room commercially. That's why it's such an effective tool. It's like, what's keeping you in prison isn't the bars. It is, but really, it's your emotion. Remember, 99% of everybody, and this goes for men and women, we may not can't remember the day that something popped off, but damn it, we know how we felt when it did. And we won't let how we feel go. And it'll resonate. And when you are arbitrating, you're trying to get past the emotion to the math.
Right. Okay, got it. So the other thing is, I'm coming back into the space.
Uh-huh.
I've heard about the banking in the box, the GPT for all the ChatGPT. Is it my understanding that this is life-changing in a way where I used to substantiate things and secure things a manual way, that this is giving me a digital way to get vehicles to just tap right into the system? Okay,
exactly.
Does it automatically transfer to the system in any kind of way, or I transfer it to the system?
Here's what you got to remember. It's about having your system in a format where others can tap into it. Asymmetrically,
gotcha.
It's not about their system. It's about your system. And then you can create a proponent where if they're in a Bank of America, they can tap into your system. If they are in a Wells Fargo, they can tap into your system. Symmetrically,
perfect.
It's opposite.
So that is perfect.
Right. So, see, you got to remember, opposite of what we're talking about, that's how it's wired. See, they expect you not to have a system, so you get to use it. And when you get down to this technology, this is going to blow your mind, but this is really what it is. It's a website with a landing page that they just give you read only. See, when you look at your bank account, all you can do is just look at it. You can't add nothing to it or take away. You can just look at the screen. That's it. All it is a page that they let you look at. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
All
so that makes perfect sense.
Listen to this now. You just got to do the same thing. That's it.
So I was just making sure I was clear. I was like, so this sound like this. Let me show this is this. Perfect.
Right.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Vane.
There you go. All right. Moving down the line. Let's see what else we got here. Let's see. Okay. Caller, last four digits of your number, 7252. 7252. Can you hear me? Last four digits of your number, 7252. Do you have any questions, comments for me? Going once, going twice. We'll move on down the line. All right. Caller, last four digits of your number is 1945. 1945. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I can hear you. How are you today?
All right. I'm pretty good. Pretty good about yourself.
I'm blessed. I have a question for you.
Sure.
File an appeal.
Uh-huh.
And the, let's say the judgment order, the 30 days to file an appeal for that is gone.
Okay.
But something else came up and you filed an appeal.
Uh-huh.
That appeal that you filed is going to directly interact or fall back on the denial that was out of the time frame. So
okay. Are you asking filing a new appeal for new circumstances, does it fall up under the same guidelines as previous?
No, this one is gonna let me put it to you like this. A friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
File for a vacation of final judgment.
Okay.
didn't know she was supposed to file an appeal to that within the 30-day time frame.
Okay.
Now the bank has filed something else.
Okay.
She filed a motion. That motion was denied.
Okay.
She filed an appeal.
Right.
But when it goes before the appellate court, the information that was in the motion is going to relate and directly affect the information, the filing that was out of date.
Uh-huh.
How would they work that?
Well, appellate courts are higher courts, and they only look at the paperwork. A lot of people are under the impression that when I appeal a case, they're going to call me up, I'm going to take the stand and give testimony. This is what happens. They look at the paper trail. And they look at the paper trail from the beginning to why you're appealing. And at that genre, if it has merits because it's a different issue, they will then make the appeal from that position. Why? Because the legal maxim says anything that's done outside of law is to be considered not done. So all that gobbledygook that happened earlier, if it was done outside of law, the appellate court disregards that information. So you have to be clear in your appeal of what you're appealing. But it gets kind of helter-skelter when we're all emotional and we want to tell everything when they can only rule on what's in front of them. So if it's a procedural, because this is where you're getting at, when this is why I don't frown on motions, but I have to explain it like this. What burns my behind with motions is that people believe that because you file one, they have to grant it. And if my son expects me to take him to the mall after I told him to take out the garbage, I don't care how clean he is when I get off of work on Friday. If I told you on Monday, if I have to touch this garbage one more time, it's going to be hell in the city. Then when he being dressed up on Friday thinking he's going to the mall, it's going to be hell in the city, dressed up or not. Case in point, the way the appellate courts look at it, first of all, you're tapping them on the shoulder saying one of y'all guys effing up procedurally. Here's the error that I captured on record. Now, they're going to look at the error and say, yep, that was an error. Did you consent? Because here's the deal. Motions get you in trouble because usually all that stuff we put on paper, we end up out of our mouth contradicting it. This is why they love talking to lawyers. But when you go to appellate court, they're not calling the lawyer. They're looking at what? Paperwork. The entire appellate process, they look at what you have documented. And if it substantiates what you have laid out in the application, then they will grant the appeal. Now, when they grant the appeal, you're going to go through a proceeding or an injunction. I'm going to use the word injunction because you used the word motion. They will grant the appeal and file a temporary injunction until the case has been resolved. But if you're smart enough to get an appeal, you're going to have to be equally as smart enough to know that once they grant it, which way to go.
Okay.
So it's procedural. So as long as you got that in writing and you got it articulated, that should be merits for them to review it properly.
Okay. But what I was referring to, if the issue of the UCC-1 was brought up and
right.
the affidavit was denied.
Listen, how can they... When you say affidavit denied, what do you mean affidavit denied?
The
was it
affidavit,
denied?
Yes.
Explain to me how it was denied.
The judge said that because he had ruled earlier on
okay.
June 12th,
mm-hmm.
that the motion to vacate the
mm-hmm.
final judgment
uh-huh.
was denied. He's saying,
uh-huh.
okay, been there, done that. I'm not going to do that again, I guess.
All right,
he
let me stop you right there.
Documentation.
Let me stop you right there. Is the judge God?
No.
Is the judge, can the judge testify under penalty of perjury of any firsthand knowledge pertaining to what you put in that paperwork?
He should be able to, I would think.
Can he testify to the fact that everything that he's saying, he's right, you're wrong? Can he testify to that? Can he testify to firsthand information? Was he there when the mortgage was written?
No.
Okay, so he can't testify to firsthand knowledge of Jack. So is hearsay. So I'm going to take baby steps. Just because this fool said something, the only way it's going to be so is you pack it up and grant that. Because it's hearsay. That's why they have a higher court. Because this fool could be off his meds. Do you understand how I'm trying to say this? It
yes.
doesn't matter what he say, because in commerce is not what you say, it's what you do.
You do.
So if he's saying he denied it, cool. That's proof of his dishonor. That's all that is. Don't be upset. This just means he is what we all know he is. He's a liar and a
Amen.
Cheat. All right. So if he's a snake, that's what he's supposed to do. I don't expect a snake to be a dove all of a sudden. I don't expect these fools to start telling the truth. I get real scared when these fools start telling the truth. The best way to tell a lie is to tell the truth in such a way you won't believe it. So because he said, I'm not going, okay, that means now you're in a personal capacity. Now I need to go after your bond. I tell you what, for laughs and giggles, nobody try this. I'm just having a conversation. I'm just humoring Miss Bess. We're just talking.
Okay.
Add him to the UCC and see how different it gets.
But don't I have to
look,
notify him?
He make an unbonded statement. He ain't provided his bonding information. He's saying he got firsthand knowledge. He was there when God say, let there be light. So let's keep don't keep that same energy now. Don't get off of it. Let's keep that. So you can't be God when you want to be and then say, well, I'm just doing what they told me. No, you can't have it both ways. It's real simple. The same oath of office that judge took as a notary, I took as well. So I'm gonna pull his coattail. All right, now who are you? And Judge Brown ain't gonna cut it. That ain't on your driver's license. Who are you? I know you got one. What's the name on your bond information? Well, I know you're a bar member. What's your bar number? Fraud is simply a failure to disclose with an intent to gain. So aren't you getting something from the Bar Association for foreclosing on my property? Oh, it get real different when you want to talk. You know, we want to talk. Ain't we here to get paid? Ain't you trying to get paid, Your Honor? I'm confused. I ain't never seen someone who don't want to get paid. But y'all people have the audacity to say that a debt is owed and won't show me how much I got to pay. How does that work? So it's procedural. Any other questions?
I just was concerned about the commingling.
Right. It's all right for them to commingle. Let them commingle all day. Just get it on record. Capture that. Take a picture up. Put that on Facebook when they commingle.
Got it.
Any other questions?
No, sir.
All right. Moving on down the line. Let's see who else we got here. Let's see. All right. We're going to go to caller. Last 4 digits of your number is 7174. 7174. Can you hear me? 7174, can you hear me? Going once, going twice. All right, we'll move on down the line. Last 4 digits of your number is going to be 9681. 9681, can you hear me?
Hello? Hello?
Greetings, greetings. Talk to me, talk to me.
I just wanted to, if you could clarify that CC9.
Okay.
Was that it?
The UCC?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, that's going to be UCC9-102, subsection A47.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And that particular UCC allows you to use an insurance as a form of collateral if you're applying for a loan.
Okay, I got it. I got it now. Thank you.
All righty. All right. All right. All right. All right. Moving down the line. Last 4 digits of the number is going to be 9074. 9074. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right. All right. Checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns of anything you heard up until this point.
And you throwing some fast pitches, man. I'm kind of slow. It's taking me a minute to formulate my thoughts, man. But I'm riding with you, though. I'm here.
All righty. All right. That's all I can. Hey, if you're riding with me, man, you'll get it. You just got to listen to it a couple of times. That's
oh,
all.
Yeah. I'm riding with you, man. I'm riding with you.
I got you, big bro. All right. That'll work. That'll work. Let's see. We're going to go down the line. Last number I got in the queue is going to be last 4 digits, 5387. 5387. I'm checking in to see if you got any questions, comments, or concerns of anything you heard up until this point.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Yeah. Okay. So what I was wondering was the UCC 9, what is that again? I'm sorry. You said it.
UCC 9-102, subsection A47.
UCC 9102?
It's going to be UCC 9-102 in parentheses, the small letter A, after the letter A, the number 47.
A47. Okay. Okay. And so another question I have, when you are in like these court proceedings, can you submit a K-1 as like a bond?
You can. There's a procedure that every court uses. So without knowing the court, let's say it this way. Yes, you can. It's just a matter of how you line that up with the court's instructions.
Okay. So, for insurance purposes, can you submit a K-1 for insurance as an insurance policy?
In order for you to do that, I'm going to say yes, you can, but it all depends upon who you are, because if you're a citizen, you might be commingling.
Okay.
So yes, you can do it if you're in the right position. And in order for me to discuss whether you're in the right position or not, you're going to give me a whole lot of information, then can I do something? Because I don't know who you are in the transaction. I don't know if you're a terrorist. I don't know if you're going to take this money and go kidnap someone. I don't know. So you're going to have to give me some more information to be a really true assistance. But in the interim, as long as you're in the right position commercially, you're not denied. As a creditor, you can do whatever you want. It's just when you start touching another jurisdiction, there are rules. I'll give an example. Whatever you're trying to do, and you're brand new to this information, let me give you what my mentor gave me. He said, whatever you finna ask me, you should produce a tax form to do what you're talking about doing. And boy, did the sparks fly. Because I realized there's a tax form for everything.
Oh, okay.
So when you bring forth the form, now we can get into UCC 9, 102 subsection A 47. Then I can tell you the state rule, and then I can tell you the federal rule, and then you'll know exactly what form to fill out to do what you're trying to do. Get it?
Right, based on the description.
Right. Remember, it's not what you say, it's what you do that determines who you are. You can tell me all day, you Big Bird. Okay. I'm just going to say, well, as Big Bird, I've never seen him fly before. Can Big Bird fly? I watched him for years. I ain't seen him take flight yet.
No. No.
I mean, he's right. Big enough to fly. He got wings. Why don't he fly? I don't know. A bumblebee got wings shorter than his body. He can fly, but Big Bird can't. I'm confused.
Right. So will a company accept the insurance that you have established? Like, say, for example, you established this insurance for your business.
What insurance? All right, let's talk about a specific type of insurance.
Insurance bond.
Insurance bond based on what?
Based on submitting it to the CRIS to have it for as a general liability.
In order for you to submit it to the CRIS, it's got to be based on something of value. What is that value?
An M3
asset that's based on what?
Maybe based on the your security. Security
in what? What is the item, the line item that gives everybody the warm and fuzzy we can do this?
Maybe the birth certificate.
Okay. Do you have a CUSIP number that you have purchased from the Security and Exchange Commission to use that birth certificate?
No.
If you answer no,
then
stop now forever, hold your peace.
Okay.
Because you're commingling. And I ain't going back to prison.
Right. Okay. So in other words, like, you can't, like, if you figured out what the CUSIP is that they have already registered.
That's their CUSIP. You're not supposed to be using a CUSIP in your public conveyances. This is a one-way ticket to prison. I'm not hollering at you. I'm just passionate.
Yeah, I understand.
That's their number. That's their shit. If you use my shit, I'm coming looking for you. You use their shit, they coming looking for you. You don't want to go to prison, leave their shit alone. Use your own shit. That's why you can pay $230 and get your own shit. Now, if you do that, you can do what we're talking about doing. That's why the penalties are so severe. You start using their stuff on your paperwork and you ain't done because we don't read. There isn't nothing stopping you from buying a CUSIP and doing what I'm talking about doing. It just kills all this paperwork game that everybody passing around. Yeah, I stepped on somebody's toe, but I don't give a fuck.
Mm.
I'm just passionate.
So you say you can buy one through who? I'm sorry.
If you can, a pair of J's costs about $140. If you can buy two pair of J's, you can get a CUSIP number. I don't understand what the problem is. You want J's more than you want CUSIP number. You can go on the website. You can swipe your debit card. They give them out like candy. It ain't rocket science.
I'm sorry. I didn't catch who you said does it.
Like If you want to know how to acquire a CUSIP, go on to Google and type in how to apply for a CUSIP. They're going to give you the website, how much it costs, what you do.
Okay.
But so when we're talking about this whole birth certificate, how do I monetize it? When you say monetize to me and you ain't showing me your CUSIP, I'm going to respond how I'm responding. I ain't going to run away from you. And I'm just playing with you, brother. I'm just trying to articulate this for future references for anyone else that's figuring this out. When you start commingling, I got to get you to realize that you're commingling. I have a fiduciary responsibility to say you can do whatever you want to do. I don't recommend doing it for these reasons. If you going to touch their paperwork and you haven't paid for the licensing fee to use it, then leave it alone. If you do the accounting, you can use a tax form to do it. See, you don't get out of not doing what I'm talking about. It's just people want a shortcut. That's why people sell you paperwork that you don't read. Or when you do read it, you take, there's a specific number that you got to put on your paperwork to do that. That's why anyone who's talking about this information, there's some things we can say, some things we all won't say. I'm going to tell you what I'm talking about. If you're trying to monetize that birth certificate and you haven't purchased a CUSIP, stop now and go get one. Then continue. Other than that, it is going to be a conversation that will end you up in a whole different jurisdiction. Because it ain't what you say, it's what you do. That's the equivalent of saying, all right, I want to use this account. It ain't my account because I didn't create it, but it's their account. But because I know it exists, I want to use it. Now, let's flip it around. If I discover your bank account, hell, it wasn't lost. What do you mean you discovered it? I didn't know it was missing. I'm gonna tap you on the shoulder again. How many of you guys that got money still in the bank received a letter from your lender saying, don't worry, your money's safe? Y'all ain't got the hint? Let me say it a different way. You got a girlfriend, right? Somebody, one of your homeboys come up to you, man, you got a good girl, man. She, you know, this, that, and the other, you know, which should bring questions like, what the fuck are you talking about my girl for? I'm going to say it a different way. If the public is your reference point, and they tell you you are safe, you're not. If they say don't worry, worry. If they say all you got to do is this, oh, hell no, you got to do a whole lot more. If you take that advice, that'll save you commercially.
Okay.
So if you want to use the birth certificate that ain't yours, pay for a CUSIP, and then we can talk about it.
Word.
This is why I'm talking about bills of exchanges. I'm talking about the DTC, the DTCC, and the security settlement system. There is a tax code. There is something you're supposed to call that birth certificate that'll let you do that. But I can't tell you that because I can't give a baby a shotgun. I'm going to tell you what happened the last time. Many moons ago, am I eager to teach? I got a big mouth. So one of the students asked a similar question. It was 40 people. 20 of them got what I said. The other 20 just heard what I said. But the 20 that got it, 5 of them was about that life, meaning that 5 of them was finna do something, you know, Like, they ain't just taking notes to be taking notes. They finna do some stuff. So these five individuals took their information and went straight into the DTCC. Out of the five, three of them stopped the process in mid-stroke. The other two heard what happened to the other three. Only one of them is still with me today, meaning they're still learning the process. Everybody that was in that class, for whatever reason, did and went on their merry way. And one thing about me, I'll tell another fiduciary this. Usually what happens with me is when everybody get what they're going to get, their phone number get changed. You know, I don't hear from her no more. I only hear from her when the bag run out. You know, when the money done ran out, they done did, now they coming back. And I always tell folks, you either see me now or see me later, but if you see me later, it's going to cost you more.
Right.
So when it comes to securitization, debt securitization, asset securitization, there's a tax form to do that. And that tax form going to want to see a CUSIP number. You can make up one or buy one. I'm just saying. It ain't what you say to me. It's what you do that determines who you are. Listen to this. If you reach in your wallet and hand someone a $100 bill, you just committed 15 felonies. They don't immediately take you to prison. They just tax your ass to death. The same way that's a felony, failure to do in this accounting is a felony also. It's just that when you don't do the accounting, they take you straight to prison. Man, I'm sorry. Look, they're getting ready to jump, kick us out, man. So, look, I appreciate everybody's time and energy. This class has been recorded. It will be made available. I'm trying to log back in. At the end of this particular proceed, we got 1 minute left. I appreciate everybody's time and energy. Look, this ain't the end. This is just the beginning. I appreciate everybody's interaction. If you got more exclusive questions, you know how to get at me. Reach me. I'm going to be at the office for maybe another hour or so. 407-792-2774. With that, I'm going to say peace and love, family. Peace and love.
Chapter 1, The Dawn of the Guardian. Title, The Genesis of the Trust Guardian and the Birth of AI. In the heart of the bustling city, nestled among a forest of towering skyscrapers, a young man named Bidzil Bey found himself in the epicenter of the financial world. His office, dimly lit by the city's ambient glow, was a testament to the complex world he was about to navigate. Strewn across his desk were a myriad of financial reports, legal documents, and trust agreements, each one a piece of the intricate puzzle of trust administration and compliance. Bidzil was not just any young man, he was a legal prodigy, fresh out of law school, with a keen interest in the intersection of law, finance, and technology. His journey was just beginning, a journey that would lead him deep into the labyrinthine world of trust law, a world filled with fiduciary duties, asset conveyances, and beneficiary rights. His mission was clear, to revolutionize the way trusts were administered. He envisioned a future where the complexities of trust law could be simplified, where compliance could be ensured with the click of a button, and where transparency was not just a goal, but a reality. This was the genesis of the Trust Guardian, a concept that would merge the legal expertise of a trust officer with the efficiency and precision of artificial intelligence. It was a bold idea, one that would challenge the status quo and transform the industry. The birth of the Syntactical Trust was the first step in this journey. This innovative approach to trust administration harnessed the power of AI to streamline processes, enhance transparency, and strengthen compliance. It was a game changer, a tool that would redefine the way trusts were managed. As Bidzill delved deeper into the world of trust law, he began to understand the true potential of the syntactical trust. It was not just a tool, it was a paradigm shift, a new way of thinking about trust administration. And it was just the beginning.